I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush's choice for the new head of the CIA is facing a Senate hearing today. A key concern among lawmakers is whether Florida Representative Porter Goss can do the job without letting partisan politics get in the way. Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia set the tone for today's hearings by grilling Goss on his nearly 16 years as a Republican congressman.
On March 8th of this year, you co-authored an intelligence op-ed piece called Need Intelligence? Don't Ask John Kerry. In it, you made a number of highly charged partisan, in my judgment, allegations, and here are a few. Quote, when Democrats controlled the Congress, the cuts were
deep. Senator Rockefeller went on for 9 minutes reviewing Goss's record and John Kerry's record. And Goss, a former CIA operative, said in his opening statement that he understands the importance of providing information to Congress.
If confirmed, I pledge to be forthright and objective in the presentation of the intelligence information to you and to the policymakers of the executive branch.
Well, joining us on the line now is Faye Bowers. She's national security correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Faye, Goss also said today that he may at times have engaged in debate with a little too much vigor. So what is the thinking? Could his work as a congressman come back to haunt him?
Well, that was certainly the part of the points that were scored today, I think, against him indicate that. One, the piece that you ran with Senator Jay Rockefeller questioning the op-ed that Porter Goss wrote for a newspaper earlier this year in which he criticized heavily John Kerry for his voting record and his bills that he introduced for cutting money to the CIA. And Rockefeller had charts up in which he displayed that actually Porter Goss's recommendations for cuts would have amounted to $8.8 billion more than John Kerry's would have. And Goss didn't dispute that, but sort of said, you know, my record is my record, stood on the ground that he wanted to be nonpartisan about this.
Well, what about that record? What about the fact that Goss had congressional oversight over what some are now seeing as intelligence failures?
Well, I think, you know, he just stuck to his my record is my record. And Senator John Warner from Virginia, the one of the ranking Republicans on the committee and who's also chairman of the Armed Services Committee, sort of took Porter Goss to task for public comments he had made about the Abu Ghraib prison abuses. Porter Goss had also, he didn't write this, but he was quoted in an Associated Press article earlier this month as saying that, you know, the Armed Services Committee should not have plucked these generals from the field to come appear before a congressional hearing to testify about the abuses. And Senator Warner kind of took him to task for that.
Well, in addition to being a congressman, Porter Goss was also a CIA operative for a long time. How's that going to play into the nomination process? How are they going to be able to ask him about things that are probably top secret?
They probably won't ask him about those top secret things. I mean, you know, he was a CIA operative back in the 1960s. He has a long public record that sort of surpasses that. He's been a member of Congress for 17 years, and he's been chairman of the House Intelligence Committee for 7 years. So my feeling is that they will focus much more on his public record.
But are they going to ask him what he did in the CIA, do you think, or...?
It's possible that they will. They haven't so far. I've been watching, and so far that has not come up.
Yeah. Well, as you know, Congress is preparing to revamp the whole intelligence community, and this is, of course, based on recommendations from the 9/11 Commission. How is that going to affect, if Porter Goss receives the nomination, how will that impact his role?
It's difficult to know for sure right now because, you know, he's up right now. He's been nominated to be Director of Central Intelligence, and that's the role that's currently on the books. To change that role to a National Intelligence Director like the 9/11 Commission recommended, that would take legislation.
Do you think they're also asking him today with that in mind, that he might be a candidate for that, or is that not even...
Yes, I think so. I think they have to assume that that's a high possibility, particularly if President Bush gets reelected, that he would name him to that National Intelligence Director position.
And Faye, with just a few seconds left, bottom line, do you think Porter Goss will get the CIA nomination?
I do.
Okay. Well, Faye, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Faye Bowers, National Security Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. As Hurricane Ivan inches slowly toward the southeastern United States, Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, made this announcement yesterday.
If you have the wherewithal to seek higher ground, to move to a different location, you should take that chance.
Meanwhile, Florida residents are still recuperating from Hurricanes Charley and Francis, and Brantley County, Georgia, soaked by the outer bands of Francis, closed its schools for several days because of the muddy roads, which is a problem complicated by attendance rules in the No Child Left Behind law. Schools are penalized and they lose funding if they have low attendance. So Brantley County closed rather than jeopardize their attendance record. Joining us on the line is Assistant Superintendent Reed Carter. Mr. Carter, you're back in school today, but we understand schools were closed for 5 days.
Due to the number of dirt roads that we have, it's difficult for us. We transport most of our students, and when we're unable to transport them, then it does adversely affect our attendance.
How did it go today?
We have approximately 87% of our students here. We normally transport around 2,000. Today we transported 768, which is considerably less than the norm, but you know, we have a lot of parents out there that we appreciate who are doing a good job of helping us have school.
Yeah, but still 80%. How many do you usually have in school?
Normally that number's around 96%, 96, 97%.
So you still had a hit in your attendance record, which, you know, as you know, affects federal funding. But I understand there's another reason here. You know, it might affect test scores as well and testing if kids can't make it to school and take exams.
Right. We want to have as much instructional time with our kids as we possibly can. Obviously, test scores are important now with the emphasis on tests by the No Child Left Behind legislation.
Right. But on the other hand, as you well know, let's say kids miss a lot of school because you want them to be able to take the test. They're also missing the studying, so it seems as if it's going to impact their test scores no matter what you do.
Well, that's probably true.
What do you think should happen here? Do you think there should be some sort of statistical allowance, some sort of mathematical computation that would allow for things like hurricanes?
We do think that. We think that there should be at least a waiver that would allow you to appeal the extreme circumstances.
The other issue, of course, is the dirt roads. About 500 miles of them, we understand, in Brantley County.
We have about 500 miles of roads. About 80% of those are dirt roads.
Right. Well, that's a lot. Can the town afford to pave them?
Oh, no, ma'am. Obviously not. But I'm sure, you know, that if they could, they would.
So, but until that is changed and until the federal requirements are changed, it'll be, you know, probably one of the few places with school closed due to mud.
Well, it's due to the fact that we're having difficulty reaching those kids, getting buses to them and transporting them.
Yeah.
And that is due to, the water, mud, erosion.
Yeah.
We have bridges that are out, you know, and we want to do everything possible to provide, you know, our children the opportunity to be here. You know, at the same time, we are concerned with their safety.
Yeah. Reed Carter is Assistant Superintendent of Georgia's Brantley County, which is right now under heavy rains from the bands of Hurricane Francis. And Reed Carter, thank you for talking to us.
Okay, thank you.
Well, two recent studies have come to strikingly different conclusions about charter schools. There are about 3,000 charter schools in the U.S. right now, but that number could increase dramatically under President Bush's No Child Left Behind policy, which embraces the charter school concept as one alternative for failing public schools. That said, the issue isn't clearly partisan. After all, Bill Clinton and John Kerry are also for charter schools. So to talk about these recent studies and to try to answer the question, just what is a charter school anyway, we're joined by Caroline Hoxby from Harvard University. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also by Howard Nelson of the American Federation of Teachers. He's on the line, and welcome to you as well, Howard.
Yes, thank you.
And as I said, each of you is the principal author of one of these two conflicting studies. But before we get to the studies, Caroline, start with you. What is a charter school?
Well, a charter school is a type of public school, but unlike a regular public school, when a child goes to a charter school, his or her parents make a decision to go to that school, and he brings along what we call a charter school fee. And on average, that fee is about 45% of regular per pupil spending in the United States. So you want to think of a charter school as having a lot of the same regulations as a regular public school. For instance, the students take the state tests, they participate in the state accountability system, and they obey a lot of state regulations. But on the other hand, charter schools are a little bit more like a private school in the sense that they really need to attract parents or they'll close.
Right.
And also, they often are free to manage their teachers in ways that are different and more innovative than those of regular public schools.
Who pays for this? In other words, who pays for the charter schools and the students?
It usually comes right from the state government, mm-hmm. so it's coming from state taxpayers. And instead of going to their regular public school, instead of following the child to the regular public school, it follows the child to the charter school.
And Howard Nelson, with the American Federation of Teachers, beyond, as Caroline mentioned, some freedom from, let's say, local bureaucracy, charter schools can be anything, right? They can be progressive, they can be conservative, just about anything. There's no overriding ideology.
Yeah, that's correct. There's a wide range in what they can do. Our organization has supported a certain kind of charter school, especially historically, the ones that deal with innovation and something new as opposed to the same old stuff that's in public schools. But the choice movement has kind of expanded the notion of charter schools to basically being about choosing schools, not about being different and innovative.
We're going to talk about that in a moment, but give me an example of some of the schools that your organization supports. I mean, what are the things that those schools might do?
Well, the original conception was that the schools would be small and run by teachers within a specific school system, and there was even the notion that a lot of the ideas would be bad and they'd fail, but the good ones could be copied. And so there wasn't this notion that every charter school had to succeed. In fact, failure was part of it.
Right, to weed out the ones that didn't work. Well, mm-hmm. let's talk about failure and success. Caroline, I'm sorry?
By the way, I disagree with the money thing completely.
Go ahead.
45% is just a ridiculous figure.
Howard, you're wrong. I'm sorry. I know exactly the numbers. These are public numbers. They're available on the U.S. Department of Education website, and every listener can go and download them right now.
Well, in the meantime, Howard, what are you saying?
Well, charter schools, by law, get the same money as public schools, with the exception of facilities, which vary by state, and that's really where the financial differential exists.
That's not correct. What's correct is that it depends on the state. In some states, like Colorado, charter schools have almost the same financial footing as public schools, but in many states, they get only the state share of school spending and not the local share.
No.
And that's why
it
adds up to 45%.
They always get the local share. That's wrong. They always get the local share.
So wait, this is one of the controversies. Howard and others are saying that charter schools get more money than you are saying, Caroline. It's just one of the disagreements. The other, as we said, is over how well they're doing and how well the test results are. So now that some of our listeners who didn't know how heated a conversation this is, we're going to come back and talk a little bit about each of your test results, and you can make the case for them when we do that. Also later in the program, the presidential race. It isn't the only close one. We'll look at some of the hotly contested Senate races around the country. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Howard Nelson of the American Federation of Teachers and Caroline Hoxbee of Harvard University are two researchers who have come up with completely different conclusions about the effectiveness of charter schools. So we want to ask each of them to present, first of all, their findings. Caroline from Harvard University, tell us, what did you find?
Well, what I did was I looked at virtually all of the charter school students who were tested in elementary grades in the United States. And what I found was that they were doing better in both reading and math. They're about 5% more likely to be proficient in reading and about 3% more likely to be proficient in math. That's the average across the entire United States.
And again, these charter schools are schools that use school funds but break away from the traditional public schools to create their own school and have to abide by testing to keep their charter. Howard of the American Federation of Teachers, what did you find?
Well, I have to explain that what we did was replicate a National Assessment of Educational Progress Study, which is the group that does the nation's report card that is often reported on. And the charter school data has been suppressed for about a year. And we found out a way to get the basic data. And what this data reveals, now it's not something we made up, it's not data we collected. This is what the nation's report card reveals about charter schools, is that straight up, charter schools compared to public schools, charter school students are about half a year behind. Mm. So we compared students eligible for free lunch in charter schools to those in public schools, and the difference was about half a year. Then we just looked at charter schools and public schools in central cities, and for math, the result was about a half a year difference and statistically significant. In reading, it was not statistically significant. And then we looked at it by race, and we found no statistical differences by race.
Caroline, how do you rationalize this difference?
I think to get at the difference between the two studies, the real difference is the data. The AFT study is a sample of 3% of the charter school students in the United States. That's about 1,700 charter school students, whereas my study has 99% of the kids. So it's not that I don't have their kids. I have that 3%, plus I have 50,000 other
Howard,
students.
Howard, does Caroline make a point? She tested more kids.
Well, the national assessment procedure has been around for 30 years, so it's pretty hard to complain about data or data quality. Sometimes it's better to have smaller amount of data that's high quality. And our data set, or the NAEP data set, has 3,000 student-level data. And Professor Hoxby's study has about 1,200 school averages. So when you talk about size, when you look at it that way, it makes a difference.
Well, what are you saying, Howard, about your overall findings? You said before that you're a supporter of some charter schools. So what is your concern? What are you saying?
Well, all schools should be accountable. And a big part of our story was that the Department of Education and NAEP had data on charter schools that they didn't like, so they weren't letting it out. And as you introduced the show with, charter schools are a very important part of No Child Left Behind. And we thought it was just very important for the public to know now what NAEP had.
Yeah. And Caroline, you know there is a lot at stake here. Some critics of charter schools worry that they pull kids and parents and resources away from regular public schools, making them fail more. As Howard said, it's part of George Bush's No Child Left Behind plan to push these alternative choices for parents. Are you in danger of wishing them to work when they don't?
Well, first of all, I'd like to remind everyone that charter schools enjoyed bipartisan support and that Senator Ted Kennedy was one of the co-authors of No Child Left Behind, which enjoyed wide bipartisan support. And charter schools very disproportionately benefit disadvantaged kids in the United States who would otherwise go to failing schools. So I think what we're really looking at here is a teachers' organization that's pro-teacher and anti-child.
As a matter of fact,
researchers who are trying to focus things on what's happening to kids.
As a matter of fact, Dr. Hoxby, you signed your name to an ad in the New York Times that was sponsored by a pro-charter school lobby group that criticized Howard Nelson's study. If you were purely an academic just trying to find the truth, why would you do that?
Because I think that we as education researchers try and take very seriously that kids in the United States deserve to have education that is based on solid scientific research. And the AFT study simply was not supported by any serious scientific education researcher in the United States.
Well,
and that's what we really objected to.
Well, Howard Nelson, I'm going to let you have the last word here with the American Federation of Teachers. Being that you're with the AFT, don't you have a sort of vested interest in the public school status quo?
I want to answer the New York Times issue, since it was our study that was being criticized by this ad. I think Professor Hoxby should follow her own advice, since she was a signer. One of the points in the ad was that you needed data from 2 points in time to show growth. Well, her new study doesn't have that. There was also the argument that you needed quality family background data. Well, our study had race, it had income in it, and it had some other things that Professor Hoxby's study doesn't have. And another key point is that these studies should be peer-reviewed and vetted. But Professor Hoxby's study seems to be straight off her computer. It wasn't presented at a professional meeting. It's not in a peer-reviewed journal. And I think if she signs on to an ad like that, she should live by the principles.
Well, Howard, I'm the one who's published studies in peer-reviewed journals. You've never published a study in a peer-reviewed journal.
Well, in the time that we have, what about the thinking, Howard, that because you represent teachers and they have a vested interest in keeping the status quo and would not support a charter school study that said that they are as effective as Caroline says?
Well, look, charter schools are public schools, and that's a very important distinction. They're not private schools. They're not voucher schools. And we have a vested interest in the public school system and making it work. And quality schools, regular schools or charter schools, it's all basically the same. Quality teachers, smaller class size, good curriculum, and extra help for kids who need it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that and let the parents who are listening make their own decisions for now. I want to thank you both.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Carolyn Hoxby from Harvard University here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Howard Nelson with the American Federation of Teachers. He spoke to us on the road. His group is based in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow on Here and Now, why are so many young people wearing silver rings? It's a pledge they've made to refrain from sex until marriage. We'll look at how abstinence is being taught today to American teenagers. And who are President Bush's Vulcans? We're not talking about the ones from Star Trek. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. It's primary day for voters in many states across the country today, but most of the hottest races will be decided on November 2nd. And while the presidential race is getting the bulk of the attention on that day, there are many other races worth looking at. Republicans now hold power in the U.S. Senate by a slim 51-48 majority, with one independent voting with the Democrats. And that means both parties are working furiously to tip the electoral scales to their advantage. Joining us on the line to talk Senate races are Jennifer Duffy, an analyst with the Cook Political Report. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey.
And Nathan.
Good
good afternoon to you. And Nathan Gonzalez, political editor for the Rothenberg Political Report. Hi, Nathan.
Hello.
We'll do the lightning round first. Jennifer, to you first. Do the Democrats stand a chance of regaining power in the Senate?
A small chance, probably somewhere between 25% and 30%.
Nathan, your thoughts?
Hard for me to disagree. A lot of good opportunities, but just tough states to win for Democrats.
Okay, and you both agree that there are hot races. Jennifer, how many do you see?
8.
And Nathan?
I see we're a little narrow at 7.
Okay, but we asked if the Democrats could regain power. Could Republicans solidify their advantage? Could, you know, go the other way? Nathan?
Definitely. I mean, there's a potential possibility of picking up 1 to 2 seats for Republicans because a lot of the Democratic open seats are in the South, areas where Bush is going to run well, like Louisiana, North Carolina, South Dakota, which is in the Midwest. But the Republicans do have a chance to widen the majority, nowhere near 60 like some would hope, but right. Maybe a couple seats.
Okay, well, of these hot races that you both define, only 2 incumbents are being challenged in those races, and they're in South Dakota and Alaska. So let's look at those first. Everyone get out your charts and graphs. Let's start with South Dakota. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle's 26-year congressional career could be ended by popular former Congressman John Thune. He was recruited by President Bush to run against Daschle. Can Thune win? I mean, South Dakota is a conservative state. Daschle is sometimes at odds with his constituents. Jennifer, your thoughts?
I think this is going to be a very close race. In a presidential year, the Republican turnout is higher. Thune ran in 2002 against Senator Tim Johnson. He lost that race by 524 votes. That race was largely a referendum on Daschle. This one is, too. This time, Daschle will need to get out there and defend his record. Thune is running a better race than he ran in 2002. I think this is going to be a race decided one way or the other by less than 1,000 votes.
Nathan, if she left anything out, add it in. But I'm going to give you the Alaska race. 2 years ago, the Republican governor appointed his daughter, Lisa Murkowski, to fill his Senate seat. Now she takes on a popular Democrat in Alaska, former Governor Tony Knowles. Might he win back a seat for the Democrats if you know, these charges that people are making of nepotism stick?
There's no question that Lisa Murkowski, her challenge was from the get-go was to overcome the nepotism issue. On her own, her resume does look good and makes her qualified, but people, I think, still have question marks about how she got to office. She survived a Republican primary from Mike Miller, an influential state legislator, who that was one of the charges that he was making against her, along with being too liberal as a Republican. But this is a good Democratic opportunity. She's going to stand in front of voters for the first time as a senator. And Knowles is the best candidate Democrats could have hoped for in this state, and it's definitely one to watch. The thing to remember is Knowles is going to be running against a strong Bush performance at the top of the ticket. It's been decades since any Democrat has done well in Alaska for president.
Okay. Well, now I'm putting the pointer on our map at Colorado. In the other hot races you've identified, some senators are retiring. That leaves open seats and wide-open races out in some of these wide-open places. Colorado, up to $30 million is being spent there. This is where Democrat Attorney General Ken Salazar is fighting Republican brewing magnate Pete Kors for the open seat held by retiring Democrat-turned-Republican Ben Nightworth Campbell. Now, isn't Ken Salazar a rising star in the Democratic Party? Jennifer, how is that going to help in this race?
Well, Democrats believe Salazar brings three assets to the race. The first of which is he is Hispanic. There has not been a Hispanic member of the Senate in 30 years. That has allowed him to raise money outside the state from the Hispanic community. He is from rural Colorado, which is territory Democrats usually have to cede to Republicans. And he's running as quite a moderate, which they think is probably the right tone for a Democrat in Colorado. Democrats hope that this is a race at the presidential level. There seems to be some question about whether that's going to stay on the Democrats' target list. Pete Kors is a first-time candidate. He's improved quite a bit, but he's going to have to run a flawless campaign.
He has all those ads going for him as well. I mean, people see him and know
right.
him.
Well, he doesn't need name ID, that's for sure.
Let's move to Florida, where Senator Bob Graham, the Democrat, is retiring, and former Florida Education Commissioner and Democrat Betty Castor is running against Republican former Bush Cabinet Secretary Mel Martinez. He wants to become the first Cuban-American U.S. Senator. Nathan, neither of these candidates seems very experienced.
I think this is a race that once Bob Graham decided not to run for re-election, we knew it was going to be a battleground. It's going to be a battleground at the presidential level as well. I think right now the interesting thing is that most of the voters, if not all the residents of Florida, are really focused on other things besides politics. With Ivan approaching, already going through two hurricanes, both candidates aren't able to advertise on television. It's hard to conduct polling when phone service is out and electricity is out. So everything is really on hold. Martinez is the nominee that a lot of Republicans in Washington, D.C. wanted as their nominee, and I think they're more optimistic than if former Congressman Bill McCollum would have won the nomination. But it's been a while since Castor's been on the ballot, but this is still going to be a toss-up race.
Okay, we want to get into two last campaigns, if we can, that are on both of your lists. Louisiana, you don't hear much about Republican Congressman David Vitter. He's running against three Democrats. There's barely a campaign commercial on the air. So, Jennifer, why should we watch this?
Well, first of all, you have to understand Louisiana's odd system. They hold a primary in which all candidates of all parties run on one ballot. If no one gets 50%, the top two, regardless of their party, go on to a runoff. Now, they hold their primary on the general election day, November 2nd. The runoff would be the first Saturday in December. Given that you have a field made up of two members of Congress, the state treasurer, and a state legislator, I think we can guarantee we'll be watching Louisiana in December.
And well, one last one. I want to get to this one. North Carolina, former Clinton chief of staff Erskine Bowles running against Congressman Richard Burr for the seat vacated by John Edwards. Nathan, just briefly in the few seconds we have, is this a vote for or against President Clinton?
Well, Republicans hope so in North Carolina, but Erskine Bowles is running a much better campaign than he did when he lost to Elizabeth Dole in 2002. He's an energized candidate. Richard Burr's campaign, I think, is still looking to get off the ground, and it's getting late. it's getting late to do that. The partisan advantage would be for Burr, but Bowles, I think, is running the stronger campaign right now.
Okay. Jennifer is looking at a race in South Carolina where Democrat Fitz Hollings is retiring. But we're going to have to leave it at that. I think we've taken people all over the map and given them a lot to think about as we head into November. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Nathan Gonzalez, political editor for the Rothenberg Political Report. Jennifer Duffy, managing editor for Senate and gubernatorial races for the Cook Political Report. They both spoke to us from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Here and Now. More than 30,000 angry Japanese protesters showed up at the U.S. Marine base on Okinawa in Japan on Sunday to protest what they describe as undue American influence on their small island. The catalyst for the demonstration was an August U.S. helicopter crash. No one was killed and only three Marines injured, but Okinawans objected to the fact that Japanese officials were barred from investigating the crash site, while pizza delivery motorcycles were allegedly waved through. But as James Brooke of the New York Times writes, there is a larger frustration, and he joins us from Tokyo. Jim, tell us, first of all, this feeling that Okinawans had that pizza delivery men were allowed into the scene of this crash site at a university, but not Japanese officials. Did that really happen?
The U.S. Marine Corps general told me there were two cordons of security, and he said the pizza guys probably got through the first one, and he said they were actually buying pizzas for the Japanese policemen. As he said, they didn't deliver pizza to the wreckage. But for the people on the outside of all the security cordons, all they saw were the Domino's guys on little motor scooters cruising through.
And they also saw the U.S. Marines reportedly stopping cameras from taking pictures and stopping officials from coming in.
Yes, especially in the first few hours, the U.S. Marines apparently behaved pretty poorly, putting their caps over TV cameras and pushing cameras down. I talked to an English-speaking Japanese diplomat who flew in from Tokyo and was not allowed to approach the site, and local police and politicians felt they were being kind of shoved around unnecessarily.
As you write, the American Marines say that they were trying to keep people from a site where they could have gotten hurt. But as you also write, there's been growing frustration over another U.S. problem, a plan to blow up a coral reef and expand an airstrip in another area. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Right after World War II, the U.S. built the strip in Okinawa. And like many downtown airports in the United States, the city's grown up around it. It's just a base surrounded by a huge community. So they've been trying to find someplace to build it, and so they ended up with this idea of actually creating a little island through landfill and building it offshore because no one wanted it onshore. And to do that, you have to blow up a coral reef and dump a whole bunch of soil and then build a floating 1-mile-long steel platform, which also happens to be right in what's called Typhoon Alley. And typhoons and helicopters aren't really a marriage made in heaven.
Well, as you write, 400 international environmental groups, 889 international experts on coral reefs, and a lot of little old ladies, well, you know, women in kayaks, are angry.
Right, especially local people. And they've had a sit-in, I think it's 147 days now, and there's this cadre of probably about 15, 60-year-old-plus ladies who've been practicing in sea kayaks last year in sort of maritime disruption techniques. And apparently when the survey ship came out there last Thursday, they swung, paddled into action.
Well, just briefly, Jim, it sounds like this is a problem we're going to hear more about. Just how are Okinawans characterizing their feeling? How are they feeling about both Japan and the U.S. at this point?
Well, they're sort of anti-both. There's strong regionalism. They used to be their own separate kingdom 140 years ago. They have a strong kind of separate feeling, and they feel they're always being stepped on by Japan. In fact, during the heat of the action, they were shouting at the soldiers, go back to Japan.
Right. Well, Jim Brooke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim Brooke, speaking from Tokyo, covers Japan for the New York Times. Stay with us. There's more. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Whether it's mainstream technology or extraordinary inventions such as Dean Kamen's stair-climbing wheelchairs, people with disabilities are functioning, if in sometimes a less-than-friendly accessible landscape, like never before. The new film Freedom Machines takes a look at some of the technologies changing lives and a look at the access to them. It airs tonight on Public Television's documentary series Point of View. And joining us on the line are Jamie Stobe, co-producer and director of The Freedom Machines. Hello, Jamie.
Hi.
And Jackie Brand. She's founder of the advocacy group Alliance for Technology Access. Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
And Jamie, let's talk first about some of these freedom machines that you documented. Before we ask some of the questions that they raise, we see computers that can scan books and read them out loud, wheelchairs, one developed, I believe, by Dean Kamen up in New Hampshire, that can climb stairs.
That's right. Most of the technology that we focus on in Freedom Machines is a lot of it is pretty mainstream technology, and we really want to emphasize how much of mainstream technology can be very useful and adapted by people with disabilities for different uses.
Well, I want to hear what at least one of these machines, and or several actually together, is doing for a young African-American girl from upstate New York. Her disability isn't made clear.
She has cerebral palsy.
And she is attending a new high school and uses a voice-activated system. Let's listen, first of all, to her using that system and then some of her hopes and dreams.
One day when I was going to the center for disabled, and a lady came on the bus and said to my bus driver, "How do you stand those people?" She pointed to me. She also said that I put in an asylum.
So we put him in asylum. I want to leave because I don't want to stay in the hospital forever. I want to see how life is outside of this thing.
I'm guessing, Jackie, that this young woman would not have been unlocked. We would not know really what was inside her without the technology she's using.
That's exactly right. And she represents so many people across the nation where the access to technology literally is so transformative that it redefines what it means to have a disability. And for LaToya, in the film, you watch her struggle to get access to these tools. It's not an easy struggle. And there, of course, is the problem that for so many people who could have such productive lives, but for access to these tools.
She's not using a voice-activated system. She's using
a voice output.
That's right. Yeah, she types into the computer and it reads the words for her because she has very low vision.
Another subject of the film is a man who's been paralyzed after an accident. He uses a mouth wand to activate a computer and a phone and to have a job. And he goes back to his rehab hospital, his nursing home, to coach another patient. Let's listen.
Think in terms of a career, because you and I both know it's going to cost you more to live now than it used to.
Yeah.
So a job, quite frankly, is just not going to cut it. You're going to need probably several levels of assistive technology.
Okay.
And that's a strategic necessity if you want to be independent.
Okay.
Stay out of a nursing home.
Yeah. Definitely.
You know, yeah, see.
Jackie Brand, how much of what is happening for people with disabilities is happening because of people with disabilities?
Well, that is the case, that it takes a tremendous amount of perseverance and push to get access to these tools. And the reason is they're not readily available in your standard technology stores, and so you really have to go the extra mile to find out about the tools. That's unfortunate. It should be much more easily accessible to the community at large.
Well, now remind us, who pays for these tools? Jackie Brand, who again has founded an advocacy group called Alliance for Technology Access, who pays for what looks like very expensive equipment?
Well, let me say first that equipment is not necessarily very expensive. The average cost of an accommodation that would allow a person with a disability to go to work is less than $500. But the question in any case of who pays is a difficult and complex one, and that's one of the problems that we're encountering today, which is that there are laws in place that say, yes, kids with disabilities in schools have the right to the tools they need in order to benefit from a public education. And yet, these laws are generally not accompanied by mandates or funds to really back it up. So it's a dilemma. And families, individuals are forced to scramble to very often to find the resources in their own pockets, sometimes to get access to a certain amount of health coverage, but it's a real dilemma for us today.
In fact, Jamie, you allude to some of this in your film, Freedom Machines. Even the laws that we have, starting with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act in 1975, are in flux right now.
Well, they're not only in flux, but one of the really interesting things about that law, which I think applies to many others, that law has never actually been fully funded by the federal government. Not funding these federal laws really just undermines the whole thrust of the disability rights movement.
Well, as you both know, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act has to be reauthorized every 5 years. This past Sunday's New York Times Magazine article on this issue points out it still hasn't been reauthorized. And that same article talks about the controversial issue of full inclusion for kids with special needs. That's when classes are rearranged around them. You know, critics say that drains resources for other kids. We're not going to debate that now, but one thing that's true is that this new technology that we're talking about is making these kids more hungry for education. So, Jackie Brand, as an advocate, what would you like to see in our educational system?
What we really need to move toward, in my opinion, is an educational system which is one single system that offers support to any students who need it, depending on ability or disability, possibly language needs, possibly emotional needs, and then we have the capacity to do better for everyone. In other words, we need to rethink the way we are delivering education. In that context, then, when everybody is getting the support they need, we're not looking at pitting one system against another. You know, I'm a parent of now an adult daughter who went through the public school systems, and I'll give you a different perspective of what that meant. It seemed to me that having her in the classroom was excellent for the kids without disabilities. They got to see that disability is just one piece of who somebody is, and they could see that the ways in which she and my daughter, the ways in which my daughter and the other students were the same were much more significant than the differences. So it was a very good experience. On the other hand, sometimes for my daughter, in order to be fully included, had to miss out on some special services that she might have gotten that she would have benefited from. But what she got instead was a sense that she had a place in her community as a part of the community along with her non-disabled peers, and that was critically important to her self-esteem and for her ability to grow up and be a part of the world.
Jackie, your daughter is Shoshana, correct? Who in
That's
the film,
right.
She's grown up to develop videotapes that will have a separate audio track that will describe the images on the video.
Right.
Yeah. Jamie, I'm wondering if the debate needs to be refocused on how to address the issue as opposed to whether or not to address the issue, because you gave some pretty startling numbers of how many people are in this population.
There are 54, 56 million people in the United States with disabilities right now. The number is probably higher than that. And when you think about it, that is a huge number of people. That's 20% of the population. And when you add in their caretakers and their families, you're talking about an incredible number of people. And then you also have to think about the fact that there are around 70 million baby boomers. And, you know, as Floyd Stewart, who's one of the people we interview, says, if you live long enough, you'll be disabled. Mm-hmm. So these issues absolutely do need to be refocused.
Well, it's a fascinating and important issue. Thank you both for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jackie Brand is founder of the advocacy group Alliance for Technology Access. Jamie Stobe is co-producer and co-director of the film Freedom Machines. Her documentary airs tonight on Public Television's Point of View series. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.